Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who lost his air tag. It's Richard Herring. Oh, yeah. Hello, London. Love to be here. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging around with the Australian band Greenhouse the other day. Oh, they're in the audience. They've come from Australia especially to see this. I think they might be touring as well. What do you guys call it? There you go. They've got it. That's what they're doing. That's nice, wasn't it? Could you tell they were Australian? Can you tell what it is yet? Oh, no. Sorry. Can't do that anymore. Can't even do that, can you? Now then. Right, so let's go. Let's move on. All of my impressions. Welcome. It's lovely to be here. This might be a long, boring story, but I have an air tag. You know an air tag? It's a thing you can find lost items. I've got one on my dog, right? It's on the collar of my dog. But we've never lost our dog. But the air tag keeps coming off. So I had to search for this air tag. It was up on the hill from my house, and I managed to locate where it was, but it was an undergrowth, and I was playing the sound, and my old ears couldn't work out where it was. The air tag is worth more than the dog. Really, I mean, the air tag is expensive, and if you lose a dog, just get another dog. But I had to find it. So I spent all weekend looking for it. Then I thought, I'll get my kids with their Sharpies. And then I remembered that you can use, there's a directional thing. But then we were in Star Trek and going like that. And it was always a foot away. We're going, why is it always a foot away? And then we realised it's because we were a foot away from the ground. So I found found it eventually. But, you know, it was a great... the kids found it. I promised the kids chocolate. Whoever found it could get some chocolate, so they were really going for it. I was the only one who wasn't involved. My son, Ernie, really found it, so well done to him. So that's the most exciting thing that's happened to me in the 3 days since I last did one of these fucking things. So, welcome. Thank you. Doing quite a lot of these at the moment. Doing quite a lot of these podcasts. So that, some of the stories are not as good as others. It's nice to be here. It's the last London one of 2023. We'll take a little while before these go out. This next week's show, I should say. So I'll be here next week. I don't know why I brought it up. I'm here next week. So it's crazy. I'm continuing to shed weight in an alarming degree, to the extent that I think maybe I'm probably a meal. The nice thing about it is you can fit back into old clothes again. This is a suit I bought about 15 years ago. And it almost fits. Look at that. Almost fits. So that's good. So that's a positive thing. Look, we're going to crack straight on because we've got an amazing guest this week. He is probably best known for being the sidekick on Terry Christian's radio show on KFM Manchester. What's he been doing since then? Nothing. And that's why that's all we're going to talk to him about. Will you please welcome the incredible John Ronson, ladies and gentlemen. It's John Ronson. John Ronson. Love to see you again.
It's lovely to be back.
It's really good to be out. You don't even live in the country anymore, so it's a rarity to get you over here.
Yep. And this is like my
fourth one, yeah. The third in here and one
on
remotely, yeah.
Yeah.
When you're in your wife's wardrobe.
In my wife's wardrobe. Yeah. It's the only place in the city where it's quiet.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd bring your wife's wardrobe to today. You could still be inside it.
My memory of being Terry Christian's sidekick. Yes. Is that we all got fired on the same day. It was me. Well, Terry Christian left earlier to do The Word, but it was me, Craig Cash, and Caroline Ahern.
Wow.
Yeah, and we were all fired. Caroline used to do the 1 in the morning till 4 in the morning.
Right.
I'd do 10 at night till 1 in the morning, and Craig would do 7 till 10.
Right.
And we all got fired. And as he fired me, he rubbed my back, like, considerately.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, fuck.
I mean, he would get fired now for doing that, John. They're not allowed to touch you.
When I did my first TV show, I sent him an autographed photo.
I mean, that's a pretty bad day at the office for that guy that he's fired you, Caroline, and Craig Cash.
I know, right? I hope he bitterly regretted it.
It's almost like turning down the Beatles, that lineup. It's almost like that. Well, look, it's great to see you. I've been re-listening, and I listened at the time. It's been a couple of years since, that Things Fall Apart?
Things Fell Apart.
Yeah, Things Fell Apart.
Maybe like a year and a half ago. We just finished season two, or just about to finish season two.
Okay.
It's about to go out. It's very good. It's for people that don't know, it's a BBC show. It's one of those shows I always kind of dread it. I realise, like, so many of my shows, when I describe them, they sound shit. They sound boring. The only thing I've ever done that sold itself was the psychopath test.
Right.
Turns out people want to buy books with the word psychopath in the title.
And find out if they are one. We'll find out later for me.
Yes.
I love your podcast, and I love the kind of... for me, you're someone who takes sort of podcasts way further than anyone else. And they are... I mean, I know they can go on the radio as well, but they feel like they feel more like podcasts than radio shows as well, which is what I like about them.
Yeah, I think so. I've got quite the work ethic.
Yes.
It's the only... I don't know. I asked Randy Newman once, like, why do you do it? Why do you write songs? And he gave a kind of sad answer, which I've grown into it being my answer.
Okay.
He said, it's how I judge myself and how I feel better. So that's why I... Why do you do what
why
you do?
Why do I do this? Because there's nothing, you know, and once you've gone this far, there's nothing else
There's nothing else. My son's grown up. I've been married for decades.
I love doing performing. I don't really count the podcast as performing, as you may have noticed in the intro. Because I never got into drugs. I used to drink, but I never got into taking drugs. But I think, like, performing stand-up is enough of a drug. And so I feel very at home on stage. I'm a very different person on stage.
I think I've got that thing of like calming all the horrors of the world by turning them into stories.
Yes.
And being able to control it by just sitting at home, just, you know, minutely editing.
Yeah.
There's just something very comforting about that. Well, I sometimes feel like one of those. You know, there's something kind of something spectrum about it.
I'm sure.
At 6 a.m. and you're just thinking about every split second of the thing, and then the next thing you know, it's 6 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good. And then time passes, then you die, and then it's over.
Yeah.
That's good. I mean, it's a great series. I think it interests me. You know that the stuff you're doing and the reasons you do it and the situations you put yourself in and the things you're discovering. I was watching. It's not a very good Simon Pegg film, but there's a Simon Pegg film about Jeff the talking mongoose. You know that story in the Isle of Man. In the 1950s, I think it was, there's always a teenage girl usually in the house when these things happen. There was a talking mongoose called Jeff that lived in the walls and would say things to people and sing. Yeah. It's a really interesting story.
Which of my stories does this remind you of?
But it reminds me of the guy that Simon Pegg plays is a skeptic but goes to look into this thing. Right. Well, most skeptics would go, well, that girl's a ventriloquist and this is clearly bullshit.
Yeah.
But he wanted to go to find out the definite truth, as if he partly wanted it to be true as well.
Yeah, I like skeptics who are willing to believe.
Yeah.
I tell you who's like that. I don't like the ones who are too rationalist, because there's something a little bit fascistic, to be honest, about overly rationalist skeptics.
Yeah.
But I tell you who I like. Robbie Williams. He phoned me up during COVID and said... he said he was thinking about like me and him going on an adventure to find out who Q is, like from QAnon, and he said,
"Would be quite an adventure, wouldn't it?"
That would There's been many times that we've nearly had paranormal adventures, me and Robbie.
Right, yes, yeah.
There was one time when he called me up and said that he wanted to spend a night in a haunted house, and could I set one up for him? And so I emailed all these ladies of the manor. Saying, dear lady, blah, I read on the internet that if the portrait in your drawing room is moved, a ghost appears. Recently, I have been contacted by the pop star Robbie Williams. And I tell you what, I expected like no one to get back to me. 100%.
Really?
They were throwing their ghosts at Robbie Williams as if they were their debutante daughters. And then he changed his mind, said he didn't want to spend the night in a haunted house.
So you used it like the kind of mad person who said, I'm friends with Robbie Williams and he wants to look at me.
Right. Yeah, no, that, yeah. I got very grumpy about that. I thought, no wonder Robbie Williams and ghosts get on so well. They both only ever manifest themselves when it suits them. But he phoned me up and he said he was thinking about, solving the QAnon mystery. He said, you know, I'm a skeptic. I've got a foot in both camps. People, I've read on the internet that people think that I am part of the, Robbie said about himself, that I'm part of the paedophile cabal.
Right.
And I know that's not true about me, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's not true about Bill Gates.
So. Right.
Yeah. Paedophile. I had a meeting at This American Life quite recently, and in America, they say pedophile.
Yeah.
So I was at this meeting and I said, paedophile. And Ira Glass said, oh, you make it sound so classy.
Good. Well, things fell apart is partly about QAnon there. That's what
it's about.
There's so many, you know, there's so much work in that series. And I know it sort of does overlap, and that's what's kind of partly amazing about it as well. But it's basically all these different stories. I think it was one of those things that it really struck me. I don't know if it's the first or the second one, but when you're talking about how the anti-abortion,
oh my god,
you know, thing started up, and it's sort
this
of incredible.
This is the craziest story. We've just finished season 2, and there's a story just as crazy.
Right.
The thing I really love about Things Fell Apart is that the stories start there. You have no idea where they're going, and they end up all the way over there.
Yeah.
So will I say the one that you just alluded to very quickly? This is amazing. 17-year-old kid in growing up in the Swiss Alps, dreaming of being a Hollywood film director, and wants to make a showreel to show Hollywood producers. So his father's a Christian art historian, and his father's like given some money to make a Christian art documentary. Yeah. Gets his son to direct, and his son's like, you know, desperate. So his son's like directing all of these action sequences to bring alive his father's theories about Jean-Paul Sartre and moral relativism. He just wants to have a showreel. So he decides to put... This is 5 years after Roe versus Wade. So abortion's been outlawed in America for 5 years. The only people protesting are Roman Catholics.
Yeah, like it's been allowed for 5 years, right?
Yeah, it's been allowed for 5 years. And Christian evangelists are like pro-choice or ambivalent at best.
Yeah.
But then Frank, this kid, just to get a Hollywood showreel, puts in these like arresting visual images of like dolls baking in the Dead Sea. Like they get 1,000 dolls and like scatter them in the Dead Sea and they're baking under the sun. And there's like an anti-abortion doctor on top of a rock saying, you know, salt, you know, all of this kind of bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
And just to get this Hollywood career off the ground, these images are so arresting that it inspires, and I know this sounds like I'm you know, exaggerating, but I'm not. The entire Christian evangelist anti-abortion movement is inspired by Frank's documentaries.
Right.
And all of these doctors who were murdered by anti-abortion activists were all inspired to do it by watching Frank's documentaries.
Yeah.
So then Frank goes off to Hollywood and makes them shit films, and it was just, it was all for that.
And it's great, but also equally, you know, it wasn't a big deal, but then actually by people protesting the other way, and it becomes a culture by people protesting against the anti-abortionists.
Yeah,
it grows and grows, and then as we've seen with nearly everything.
Yeah, there's a terrible danger, as we know, in defining ourselves as being in opposition to other people.
Yeah.
And that's what the whole world is right now. We define ourselves by being in opposition to other people. And those of us who were trying to be in the middle, like, tried to, like, make everybody, you know, like the old man standing on the battlefield saying, you know, everyone calm down. We're getting more and more niche.
Yeah.
You know, there's less and less room for people like us now.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it is just so... I mean, are you doing all this research yourself? How do you find all these stories? It just seems... Because, you know, I've never heard anything about that. So
no.
You would think that would be big news. So that's
well, I mean, I'd love rabbit holes. The reason how I found that one was I was reading a book about the culture wars. And all the characters in this book were all, you know, everyone you'd imagine, Jerry Falwell, you know, preachers or politicians. And in the middle of it, there was just a very quick passing reference to a Christian art historian.
That's right.
And I thought, oh, that's what you're looking for, that moment when you think, oh, I didn't expect that. So I went down a rabbit hole about this guy, and that's how I found out about his son.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, as you say, it must be very intensive work
to
create a series like this. So,
Can I tell you a story from season two, which is coming out? Similarly, like, extraordinary.
Yeah.
So in Miami in the 80s, 32 women were found dead in mysterious circumstances. They were all black sex workers, and the police just couldn't figure out how they died. There was no signs of death. They were all found in the same position, and low levels of cocaine were found in all of their systems, but they had nothing else in common. So the deputy chief medical examiner declared that he had determined the cause of death. And these women had all spontaneously dropped dead, he said, as a result of a combination of cocaine and sex.
Right.
When I told a friend this, she said, well, how come I'm not dead? And he gave it a name.
Yeah.
And the name was excited delirium.
Right.
So anyway, to cut a very long story short, and this is like, can I ask, if anybody's going to like, I know no one's on Twitter anymore, but if anybody happens to still be on Twitter, can you just not tweet this?
They'll be good. They're very good, my audience, apart from the occasional journalist scum.
Yeah.
Who's going to agree not to do this?
Anyway, because the whole story is just so amazing and it will be out in January.
Right.
Anyway, it turned out that it was a serial killer. Like, of course.
Of course, yeah.
And anyway, this doctor was undaunted. And he carried on going around America, like, telling everybody about his theory of excited delirium. And excited delirium starts getting taught in police training schools. And guess who learned all about excited delirium and how you have to, like, subdue them because they have superhuman strength. Because women die in relation... Women die because of a combination of cocaine and sex, and men just go crazy. They rip off their clothes, they run through traffic, and you have to subdue them. And who learned all about excited delirium? This complete, you know, bogus bullshit diagnosis, Derek Chauvin, who then went on to murder George Floyd. And as they stood around George Floyd's body, they discussed excited delirium.
Wow.
This diagnosis that is... I'm so interested in pseudoscience in high places. You know, people like us sometimes, that the you know, it's easy to make fun of, you know, backwards Christians and rednecks. But the fact is, you know, pseudoscience and magical thinking exists in the highest places. Mm. It's what my book, The Many Stereo Goats, was about how, you know, military leaders thought that they could walk through walls and kill goats just by staring at them.
Yeah.
I met a colonel in the military who was part of a secret unit called Project Jedi.
Right.
And I asked him, he said Project Jedi was a series of levels. And I said, what was level one? He said, level one is observation. You walk into a room, how many chairs are in the room? The super soldier would just know. So I said, what was level two? He said, level two was intuition. You're at a fork in the road. Do you go left? Do you go right? You go right. And I said, what was level three? This was like the easiest interview I've ever done. I said, what was level three? He said, level three was invisibility. And I said, so that's kind of a leap from that. I said, well, actual invisibility. And he said, at first, but after a while, we adapted it to trying to find ways of not being seen. And I said, like camouflage. And he went, no. And then he said, level four was we had a master sergeant that could stop the heart of a goat just by wanting it to stop. And I said, did he ever manage it? And he said, one time, but his heart got damaged in the process. And I said, what, was the goat psychically fighting back? And he said, no, the goat didn't stand a chance. In paranormal circles, it's called sympathetic injury. Anyway, I was watching that footage. I filmed that in Hawaii in, like, pretty much 20 years ago, yeah. 2003. And I was watching the footage, and my wife came home, and I said, look at this. And she was a bit drunk. And she said, you should call it The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Right.
Yeah. And then years later, when they turned it into a movie, they told me that it was the title, The Men Who Stare at Goats, that made them want to do the movie.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you,
and
Elaine.
When I did Celebrity Pointless, they did books with animals in the title, and Robert Lindsay's daughter got the go before me and said that, so I couldn't do it. So I had to guess the title of a Dr. Seuss book instead. I got that right then. but I think that's the whole thing with this particular series, because, you know, some of it's very funny and some of it's really not funny. Some of it's absolutely tragic. Yeah. The story about the childcare people, it's really interesting because the childcare story is really interesting because it's about the paranoia that comes out from suddenly parents not looking after their own kids.
Yes. But, so this is the early 80s, and daycare centres for the first time in America start, you know, cropping up all over the place. So, you know, parents are dropping their kids off at daycare centres and feeling really uneasy about it. And and suddenly, like, this moral panic. At the same time, Christian radio stations were running these stories about how there was, like, rituals happening on, like, streets in America. And, you know, these people were phoning up these Christian radio shows and saying, you know, I was kidnapped by Satanists and I was passed through a dead horse, like, from head to anus. as part of the ritual. And then, like, CNN got involved, not to debunk these things, but to say, well, maybe they're true. And so that was happening at the same time as the daycares were cropping up all over America. And suddenly, like, these kids were, like, being interviewed by the police.
Yes.
And the kids would, like, come up with, the, you know, these are, like, four-year-old kids. And they say, well, the teacher put a bomb in a hamster and exploded in front of the class. Yeah. And the teacher made us go to a cemetery and dig up bodies. And then they, like, obviously they were getting back to daycare in time for pickup without any mud on them. But nonetheless, like these kids were believed and people went to jail. And there's one woman called Kelly Michael, who I interviewed in Things Fell Apart, ended up, she got arrested and charged with making the children roll around on razor blades, and she was playing Jingle Bells in the nude on a piano. Yeah. This was in a church, you know, this daycare centre was in a church where people were coming in and out all day.
Yeah.
And she ended up getting sent to jail for 47 years. And she got out after 5 years because a civil rights activist took her case and, you know, managed to get her exonerated. But yeah, she said to me exactly what I just said, like, you know, you think this is going to be like backwards people who believe this shit.
Yeah.
She said that all the parents who were, like, you know, pointing the finger at me and you know, saying they believe the children, they were accountants, they were lawyers. This was in a really fancy part of New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, this was an upscale daycare centre. And he said, you know, you put away your advanced degrees, you know, we can all fall for moral panics.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I mean, you've always been at the forefront of all these things. You always sort of spot things before everyone else, it seems to me. But that, yeah, obviously this goes back to the you've been publicly shamed, which obviously was a good few years ago as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, that this, it is this sort of craziness where, and we are, it's sort of, I mean, there are a couple of episodes of the first series which have a bit more kind of a positive message, but it's quite a, you know, it's quite a, do you think we're coming through the other side of this and people are getting fed up of it, or do you think it's going to get worse?
Well,
it just feels the moral panic and the judge, you know, people being judged.
Yeah.
And incorrectly judged about things they've done, you know, with no evidence or with ridiculous. I mean, the evidence in that case is so ridiculous that the idea of someone going to prison for 5 years.
Yeah.
It's just,
as she said, not for a crime that I didn't do. She said for a crime that never happened.
Yeah.
I would have thought that we were coming out of it, but I don't think that anymore. Like, look, I don't think we should go here in this particular happy environment. But, you know, Israel Gaza just shows that we are so conditioned to be on one side. We're so conditioned to that now, and to define ourselves as being in opposition to other people.
You would hope that eventually, I mean, I suppose it's, you know, it's not, I could say eventually, but of course it's happened all through human history anyway, so it's unlikely to absolutely change, but it does seem to be, you know, it's fueled by the internet, right? I mean, that is the
it is, but it's inside all of our brains too. I remember when I was writing The Menesteric Goats, I said to this guy who worked for the CIA, I said, oh, why are there so many people even inside the CIA that believe all of this crazy shit? And he said, because people are nuts. Yeah. And you see it everywhere. You know, I gave a talk at a podcast festival in Belgium a couple of days ago.
Right.
And, you know, we were talking about this. And you know, the fact is, you know, we shouldn't mock conspiracy theorists because we are all prone to it. And I said, well, true crime podcasting, that's kind of like conspiracy theories. You take a little slither of information and then you run with it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing on social media. Every day we define somebody by a poorly worded tweet. And then, you know, we think we know everything about that person from you know, a slightly misjudged tweet.
Yeah.
It's like we all do it. You know, this magical thinking happens all over the place. We do it all the time.
Oh, we're fucked. Right, good. Good.
However, I'll tell you why we may not be fucked.
Okay.
Well, in season one of Things Fell Apart, the most popular show was The Nicest Show, which was about how Tammy Faye Baker, the televangelist, had on a pastor with full-blown AIDS called Steve Peters, and how they came together Because obviously the televangelist community in the 80s were very, you know, homophobic, and Steve came on to Tammy's show and Tammy was crying and Steve was so good. And I told this story and we had Steve on the show because unbelievably, I called the show a miracle. And one of the miracles is that Steve didn't die. He was the longest surviving person with full-blown AIDS in history. Unfortunately, he died in June.
Right.
But he was supposed to have died in, you know, 1984.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary. Anyway, the number of people who told me that they had to pull over the car because they were listening to it and crying so hard.
Yes.
So that's a little slither of hope, yeah. Right?
I mean, it's still about a man having AIDS and she dies of cancer before him. So yes. And now he's dead.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know. I thought there's a little sliver of hope, but at least he's still alive. Now that's gone.
I've got to say, that's the best I've got.
But, you know, it's fascinating that evangelist Christian was stepping back and going, oh, hold on, are we being Christian, you know, are we being Christian to people, you know, which seems, you know, people seem to have lost sight of, in so many things, in politics and religion, to have lost sight of the central message of what they believed in and almost believed the opposite of what.
Yeah. I mean, all of Tammy Faye's contemporaries were so homophobic that they're the ones who convinced President Reagan to not say the word AIDS. And Reagan didn't say the word AIDS for 3 years while the epidemic was you know, proliferating. So, and obviously, you know, the deaths happened in silence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Good.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's just such a fantastic series. And as I say, today I was just sort of, I'll catch up on a couple of them because I'd listened to them all before, and I just ended up listening to all the last. I thought I know the first two. I'll listen to all the rest. It was, you know, it's such a brilliant series, and it's so fun. Well, do you think, like, because obviously you've written the debutante, which was an audio experience, really, but you haven't written an actual book.
No, I am writing a book now.
My
first book since So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which was 2015.
Right.
And I'm finally writing another book.
Good.
Yeah. I've written the first two chapters. They're very good. but I can't say what it is.
Can't say what it is.
No.
But have you missed writing? Because it'd be, you know, obviously there's so much effort has gone into these very, you know, there's four or five podcast series, I suppose, that you've done. And
making podcasts is more fun because you're working with a producer and it's structured, and you know, we text each other back and forth. When you're writing a book, You're basically just a man sitting in a room who thinks he's writing a book. And any previous success means nothing. You're just a man sitting in a room.
But are you going... I mean, you presume you're going out and doing things for the book and you're researching. I'm guessing, if, you know, we don't know what it's about.
Oh, yeah.
It could be just about you sitting in your room.
No, yeah, I can't tell
us what it is, but you are, you know...
I was going to say that I have to have adventures. Like, yeah. I can't be a polemicist. I can't just sit there and come up with, you know, thoughts... Yeah. I have to solve mysteries and go on adventures. So that is what I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah, good. Well, you know, because the books are so fantastic, and you've done so well as well that you would think your publisher would just be going, "When's the next book coming out, John?"
They do say that. But you know what? I can't think of anything worse than selling. You know, standing on stage talking about a book that I don't believe in.
Yeah.
Like, I would rather, you know, I'd hate to bring him up, but, you know, Stuart Lee.
I hate to bring him up.
Yeah. But
he is the kind of person who would just stand on stage trying to sell the book they didn't believe in. You are right about that.
No, sorry, he said something. He said something one time that I've always remembered, and it kind of haunts me. He said, "You spend half of your life building a legacy, and then you spend the second half of your life destroying the legacy." And I'm just determined to only ever write books that I, you know, I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
And so that's why it sometimes takes several years.
But The Debutante, which was an audible, it's sort of a podcast, but it could be a book as well. I mean, it's an audio book officially. It's fantastic. We talked about it on the book club quite recently, so go and look that one up. We won't necessarily talk about that again. I saw you, within the Things Fell Apart, there's a bonus episode where Louis Theroux interviews you about the series, and it's quite nice because it feels like the two of you have
made up
and come together.
Well, I tell you what you know made me so pleased was he said that he was jealous of me sometimes. I thought I was jealous of him sometimes, and he just didn't care. But no, so I was delighted about that, to hear that, me and Louis. I've said this joke so many times, but I'll say it again, that I used to think that we were like conjoined twins, me and Louis, and that for one of us to grow stronger, the other one had to die. But I matured my way out of that destructive thought spiral.
There's definitely room for both of you, and I think, but you know, and there it is, you are doing different things, I think.
Obviously,
yeah,
Louis
has
skills that I do not have. I mean, Louis is so good at being in the moment and saying something so funny and so sharp. And I think I'm good at constructing stories. Yeah. So it's two very different things.
Yeah. Backstage, there was something that interested me that you kind of touched on when we were doing our exclusive interview for people who have joined us on Acast Plus. We were talking about staying up all night, and you said you stayed up all night. I don't think we talked about maybe we talked about this before, but I don't think we did. Staying up all night with a superhero called Phoenix Jones?
Yeah, a real-life superhero called Phoenix Jones in Seattle. He dresses up in a superhero outfit and thwarts crime. Unlike the police, he gets very frustrated if he can't find any crimes to solve. So I was with him all night. And yeah, it was like 3 a.m, and we hadn't found a single crime to solve. And he was so pissed off. And at one point he saw a man hand a little bag to another man and he went, "Yahtzee!" And he like ran across the road. I think Yahtzee was his superhero saying.
Did he have to throw 5 dice to get the same number on each freaking...
Right. No, and he said, what did you just give that other man? And it was a pretzel. It was a bag of pretzels. So then he said, okay... he was so frustrated. He said, "Okay, we'll have to go and break up some crack dealers in Belltown." So I thought, "Okay." So we went round the corner. It was like 3 a.m. by now, and there was like, honestly, there was like so many gangs of crack dealers, like as far as the eye could see. And he turned. There's me and Phoenix and 2 other superheroes, all in their full outfits, their full regalia. They don't carry nets anymore. You know the nets?
Yeah.
They don't carry those anymore because if you let the net off, that sometimes you get ensnared in the net. So he didn't have a net, and he didn't have grappling hooks.
Okay.
His point was, okay, you can scale a building with grappling hooks, but when you get to the top of the building, what are you going to do? You're just stuck at the top of a building. So no grappling hooks. Okay. But nonetheless, he was still wearing his like bulletproof vest and everything, and his sort of, you know, super suit. And his crack dealers all like looked at him and said, "What the fuck are you doing here in your stupid costumes?" They said, "This may be fun and games for you, but this is how we feed our families."
Right.
I was at this point, because it surrounded us, I was at this point like nodding in agreement with everything that the crack dealers were saying. In the hope that if the shooting started, they would shoot around me. Because everyone else was like wearing a, you know, bulletproof suit. I had a cardigan on. And then they all went down the block, and then just one of them came back up and walked past us. And as they walked past us, he whispered, "If you don't get off our block, we're going to show you what the burner does." And then just like carried on and looped around. And like I thought, you know, from watching The Wire, that a burner was a mobile phone, yeah, without a SIM card. But that didn't sound contextually right.
We're going to show you away a phone in front of me. It'll be you next.
And then he like showed us like his gun underneath his waistband. Right. So I was so scared. Yeah. Phoenix and the other guys were like, "Do we stand or do we leave?" And they all went, "We stand." So I, like, a taxi went by. And so I, like, frantically hailed the taxi and the taxi driver. And the taxi driver was, like, petrified. And he was like, I've got to go. And I'm like, "Look, please, just, like, stay." Because I didn't want to miss the moment, but I also didn't want to, like, die.
I mean, you're a good journalist, John. You were going to run away, but... Yeah. Got to look at it from a distance.
Also, I thought that if I kept the taxi door open, and I could like watch what was happening, but I could be standing behind the door. So if they shoot, the door could be my bulletproof vest.
And bullets can't go through the doors. Glass in them.
I mean, I don't know. Anyway, they all walked towards us, and they got to us, and one of them said, "You are dumb motherfuckers. You are so dumb." He said, "But if you're just going to stand here, I guess we could shoot you or we could go home. And I guess we're just going to have to go home." And they all went home.
Oh, they talk the talk.
That was a crazy night.
Imagine if you'd stood with the superheroes, how great you'd have felt rather than hiding in a taxi.
I know. Well, thank God I stayed. There's been a couple of occasions when I've wanted nothing more but to go home.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that I stayed. The other time was when I snuck into Bohemian Grove with Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was terrifying, but thank God I stayed.
You've got to stay. Look, tell us something. You've been like doing quite a lot of live stuff and touring and doing writing workshops and things like that.
Got some writing workshops coming up. I'm doing Psychopath Night 2024 in October and November. So yeah, that'd be good.
So what's that? That's based on the 20th anniversary.
Yeah, 15th anniversary of the psychopath test. And right. I'm writing a whole new show about, you know, psychopaths and how to spot psychopaths, and also the tyranny of if you get too into spotting psychopaths, it kind of turns you a little bit psychopathic. Yeah, the book, for people who don't know, I discovered that a lot of like Harvard psychologists, like important people, are all convinced. This is kind of a known thought now, but it wasn't at the time, that you're 4 times more likely to find a psychopath at the top of the tree than at the bottom.
Yes.
So when I heard that thought, I thought, well, that is the most incredible thing I've ever heard. Like, it's the kind of glib thing that can just pass you by. But when you think about it, it's like there's one particular mental disorder, they were saying, and it's the worst mental disorder in the world. And that's the one that our society has rewarded, like pushed to the top. So I thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go on a psychopath spotting course and learn how to spot psychopaths and then journey into the corridors of power and spot psychopaths.
Yeah.
So that was the book. That was the psychopath test.
I mean, there's more now, though, 15 years on, than there were.
Oh, sweet God, yeah.
I mean, I think most of them read the book and thought, oh, okay, there's a career path for me.
Yes. There's a line in the book that says that if you're worried, you know, if you're reading this and you're worried that you might be a psychopath, that means you aren't one.
Yes.
Because psychopaths never worry about being psychopaths. What is there to worry about? Like, it's got to be, you know, there's no remorse, no empathy, no, you know. As an anxiety sufferer, my amygdala is constantly shooting signals of distress and fear and remorse up and down to my central nervous system. Psychopaths have an underactive amygdala, which means no remorse, no, you know, it must be the most pleasant feeling of all the mental disorders.
And it's difficult to tell whether, that, you know, get into those positions, most people go, oh, I don't think I can do that, or I don't know if I'd want to do that, I don't know if I'd want that, you know, that all that worry and all the conscience involved in that. So, you know, it's more likely that for that reason that those people end up in charge.
Yeah. Well, as somebody said to me when I was writing the book, if you take loving kindness out of your brain, like, what's left is just the will to win.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, society comes along and rewards those traits.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you have a psychopath at the top of a company and then they fire 30% of the workforce, the share prices go up. So, you know, who's the psychopath?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they either become politicians or comedians, I think, the psychopath.
Right.
So there are definitely a lot of comedians, I think, who are psychopaths.
Oh, yeah.
And which is weird, because you would think you would need empathy and understanding, but you don't.
You can fake it.
You can fake it.
Yeah. Oh, there's in the psychopath test. I tell a story about this. In the 1960s, they decided to, you know, an experimental psychologist in Canada decided that the problem with psychopathy is that it's buried deep beneath the surface. So you can bring it to the surface. So you can treat it. So he got all of these psychopaths and he made them take massive amounts of LSD and have these naked LSD fueled psychotherapy sessions. Which went on for weeks, you know, off their heads on huge... If they got hungry, they would have to suck liquid food through straws that were protruding from the walls. Anyway, after weeks and... after weeks and weeks of this, the psychopaths started changing. They started being more empathetic. They would like... And I've seen film of it. They would say to each other, you know, you have so much love in your eyes and all of this stuff. And you know, it was declared a great success. And then they were released out into the world. And then years later, some psychologists did a long-term recidivism study, how many of them had gone on to reoffend. Now, in normal circumstances, 60% of high-scoring psychopaths go on to reoffend. But the psychopaths who had been through the naked LSD-fueled sessions...
Yeah.
80%. And one of them was asked, like, you know, why? And he said, oh, it taught us how to fake empathy better.
Yeah. It is sort of, you know, I find it astonishing in politics, you know, the politicians, you can sort of understand why, in a way, I suppose, with politicians, within show business, you know, so many times people get into these positions of power.
Well,
And then abuse that power, and everyone turns a blind eye to it. There's so many people trying to get on in show business, you would just think, why don't they just, like, not employ the cunts anymore? Just say, they employ the cunts and the cunts are cunts.
Yeah.
But they bring in enough money that you go, oh, he is a bit of a cunt, but let's, you know, they're getting enough money. You would think they would just go, it's easier to have a nice person doing this job.
Well, I mean, everyone who watched the Russell Brand documentary, saw that his comedy routines were absolutely echoing the allegations. And... did we, you know, back in the weird early 2000s, everyone was fine with it.
Yeah, I think you can't, because that is part of comedy. If you said everything that a comedian says is high, you know, I did 10 years of comedy about fucking animals and I've never fucked an animal.
Right.
yeah, no, I...
Yes, I know what you're saying.
And, you know, and so you would, and also like there was a big period. It's interesting. There was a big period of time where comedians were all rape was the punchline to loads and loads of comedians' jokes. There was a big period of time when paedophilia was a punchline to everyone's jokes, and it still is for me. And so you can't go. Comedians are sort of reflecting what is the thing that is scaring people and upsetting people. So that's why someone can hide in place and can say the exact things they're doing. But I don't think it means.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think it follows, but yeah, it is. You know, it's a freaky, it's a weird example and a weird thing. Yeah,
sure. It's still interesting to go back to that period, which we both lived through, the early 2000s, where things were very different. I mean, the past is another country.
It is, I'll look back. And most of my things I've done jokes about, I'll look back and go, oh yeah, and I was sort of on the right side there. I was more or less on the right side there. But every now and then you go, oh, tastes change and things change, and it's very. You know, you can look at things with hindsight. There was a thing I was going to talk about in the next thing with me and Stu. They've just repeated our Top of the Pops episode that we did. But the show opens with me going, look, we're in the Top of the Pops studios. We're surrounded by sweaty teenage girls. Have I died and gone to heaven? And with the benefit of hindsight, that seems an inappropriate thing to say. But the character I was playing in the double act was that was this kind of virgin who would never get anywhere, then who was just obsessed with sex. So it made sense, but like obviously because of the things that have happened since.
Yes.
Quite a few people wanted to cancel me retrospectively on Twitter and track me down and find me. But it's very, occasionally those things come up from anyone's career. I think he's had a long period of time going, ooh. We're also discussing backstage as we're getting older. We've both had surgery in the last couple of years.
Yeah, you had your testicle. I had a foot of my colon taken out.
It's better than having a colon of your foot taken out. What do you think's worse? What do you think?
Oh, mine's worse.
You're thinking a colon?
Yeah.
You've got loads of colon.
It goes all the way up to the ceiling.
Yeah.
I said to the surgeon the next day, I said, so how much did you take out? And he went, oh. So I was in hospital for 2 nights. It wasn't that bad.
No.
It was the minor end of major surgery. There was a moment, though, when I must have looked, because they took it out of my side.
Right.
There was a moment when I must have looked like one of those lithographs of heretics being tortured from like the 14th century. There was a moment when that happened.
Well, both of us, I suppose. You went for the general anaesthetic rather than local anaesthetic.
Yeah.
Were you offered? I was offered. I could have watched my.
Oh really?
I could
oh
have
no.
My
not.
Testicle being removed. If I'd wished.
Yeah. He said to me, "Oh yeah, colon resection surgery. If you want to know what it looks like, it's on YouTube." And I'm like, "I'm not going to fucking look and see what you're about to do to me." The day after my surgery, you're supposed to walk like as soon as you can. So I was like walking up and down the hospital corridors like at like 3 in the morning, and I walked past a room. And there was this old guy, this crotchety old man in the room, and a nurse was trying to, like, you know, do something with this guy and was chatting to him. And as I walked past, the nurse said, what did you used to do when you worked? And the guy went, irrelevant! I laughed for the whole rest of my hospital stay.
Is there a period where you're not allowed to poop for a while? Do you have to hold off pooping to keep your colon?
Oh, no, quite the opposite.
Really, you've got to poop as much as you can.
As much as possible, yeah. Right. But I'm all better. I mean, it's incredible. I'm all better. Major surgery, foot of colon removed. By the weekend, I was out walking 8-10 miles a day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
I was not. I wasn't even overnight. I was in the morning and then went home.
Right.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, it's incredible. But like as we were saying backstage, we're just getting to an age where, you know, we're all in a few pieces.
Well, we're all supposed to have died at 50, right? Yeah. Isn't that the rest of it, as Raymond Carver said, it's all after that. It's just all gravy. Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll become gravy the way things are going. That's and you've been living in America for a while, really, haven't you?
Been 11 years.
Yes.
Yeah,
but you've become a naturalised American citizen.
Yes.
Why did you want to do that when you've done so much work to say how crazy it is in America?
Right. Because Trump was president and it felt like he could at any time just take away the protections that you have if you have a green card.
Yeah.
Like we were just scared that Trump would change the law and we wouldn't be safe in the country anymore. So we became citizens.
Right. Yeah. How are you finding it?
I like it. I miss my friends. I miss, things about London. I miss my friends. But I love it. I live in Greenwich Village now.
That's pretty nice.
It's amazing. I mean, I love it. We live on the third floor and I've got a little balcony and I watch people we live right opposite an ice cream shop. Yeah. So I just watch people eating ice creams and walking their dogs and it just gives me an enormous sense of happiness and well-being, just being part of... A little bit like our old dog, Floppy. He wanted to be around people but not interact with them. So that's...
So he's three floors up just watching ice cream.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, that I love.
Yeah.
The geography of America, I love, but I miss the people of the United Kingdom.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a strange thing to change locations in that way. But are you as big in America as you are in the UK? Are you sort of recognised in America, and do you tour in America?
Not as much, no. But kind of out of choice. Like I don't really love touring,
right?
So it's not like we didn't move to America for like career advancement reasons. I think the reason why we moved was like Kennedy said about going to the moon. Like sometimes you do something because it's hard. And in fact, I mean, on a personal level, my son loved it. I mean, we're all very happy now. For the first year, it was a bit rough, though.
Sure.
It makes you realise just how fragile the line is between confidence and wanting to isolate. Like as soon as you're in a foreign place, so for the first year, it was really rough. Now I love it. I forgot where I was going with that.
Yeah, I found the same moving to Hertfordshire, I have to say. So I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't think I could live abroad. I like travelling, but I do love the United Kingdom in spite of everything.
Yeah, no, me too. But I do really like Americans. I like my American friends. I've got some, expat friends.
Yeah.
I see Maeve Higgins, the comedian.
Oh, yes,
yeah, me and Maeve see each other pretty much, a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
I've got a nice little sort of group of friends there and I like being alone, so I can just like lose myself in America.
Yeah. I mean, New York's a pretty special place.
I run every day, I go running and I run to the river and I pass a plaque, and the plaque is where Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly used to busk.
Right.
Which basically means that entire genres of music, folk music, American blues, kind of started in this basement about four doors down from me.
Right.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, thanks a lot for abandoning us and everything you've done. Well, look, there's so many things we could talk about, and there's so much coming up, clearly. So watch out for the second... Listen to the first series of Things Fell Apart, and I'm very much looking forward to the second series. The debutante is absolutely brilliant. Listen to the podcast we did about it, but more importantly, listen to the... Yeah. Is that just on Audible, or is that...
That's available? Just on Audible. Yeah. It's just behind the paywall. And come to Psychopath Night 2024.
Yeah.
I've got mystery guests.
Are they psychopaths, or do we not find out until... Are celebrities coming in to find out if they're psychopaths? I'll give you a list. Look, always love to see you, John. Thank you for coming on again. Do look out for all of John's amazing stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing John Ronson. Come back next week to see some more. Thank you. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, John Ronson. Scant regard, do the music. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, and Ben Evans, not that one. And thank you, Devon, at the Leicester Square Theatre for having us, and all of Chris's crazy team. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterSkype.com production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.